It's not a part of me that I'm missing. It's a part of you I miss kissing. So baby, tell me where's the dream. It's not a part of you.
Well, all right. We are off and a-running. My name is Jordan Ferber, guys, in case you didn't know. And you're listening to Where's the Grief? I am sitting today with author Dr. Merrill Ayne. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Jordan. Thank you for having me and for doing this wonderful service for people to allow them to talk about grief. It's really a wonderful thing.
Yeah, well, I think you obviously are in the same pipeline. I mean, you've kind of given a voice to a lot of people as well. Your book is the Living Memories Project. And you have quite an online presence as well, beyond just the physical book. It's sort of an online thing. You've given a lot of people an opportunity to tell their stories and share with the world the things that they've done to allow the legacies of their lost loved ones to continue, which I think is a really important, for me, it's been a really important part of my journey.
Great.
Yeah. So how long ago did the book come out?
The first book, The Living Memories Project, Legacies That Last, came out in March 2014.
Okay.
And our new book, which is a companion journal, My Living Memories Project Journal, just came out last week.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. What kind of, have you gotten a lot of good feedback on the book?
We've gotten great feedback on the book. So the story, my story was that I lost both my parents within a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
My father had been sick for about 10 years. And so, you know, it was a slow decline, and we knew that he was going to die. My mother had nothing wrong with her. She was a picture of health. She did not take any medication, and she just got a freak cancer.
Mm.
And we lost her in 6 months. And my mother was my best friend, my confidant, my sounding board. And I, even though I was a grown person,
right,
with a family of my own, I just said, how am I going to go on living without my mother? So I started talking to people about grief and loss. And I learned that there is no such thing as closure. When you love someone, you know, people say, oh, move on, you'll get over it. That person is with you in your heart and your mind forever.
Mm-hmm.
But what I also learned is that people took many different approaches to keeping that person alive in memory. And I spoke to my husband and my brother, who are also writers, and I said, this sounds like a book. How would you like to help me? And we will interview people about how they keep their loved one's memory alive, how they keep that presence in their life after they're gone. So that was the genesis of the first book. The second book is a way, after people read the first book about how other people keep their memories alive, they can then evoke their own memories and take steps to do something tangible if they choose.
Right. Yeah, I think it's very important to be able to kind of ask the right questions that bring the story out.
Yeah, and that's what we try to do in the new book.
Right. I mean, because as a writer myself, you know, it's always so hard to sit down and write. You know, you just sit down and stare at the blank page for like 45
right.
minutes before you figure, okay, you know, let's go get lunch. You know?
Right. Writer's block, that's
right.
called. Right.
Yeah. How was the process of collecting those interviews? I mean, how many are there interviews that didn't make it into the book? Did you do a lot of?
There were a couple of interviews that didn't make it into the book. We had to get everybody's permission. So after we wrote up the interviews, we sent it to people. There was one person who said he had discussed it with his family and didn't want to be in the book.
Mm.
And then there was someone who had passed away and his wife just didn't want it in there. She wasn't happy with what her husband had said. So obviously we didn't print those. So I think we lost about two of the stories, but most of them did make it into the book.
But pretty much every story in the book, you did get personally, or some of them you found elsewhere.
No, we got them all. We got them all personally.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I like the Jack Klugman one.
Yeah, I thought you would. One comedian to another, right?
Right. Well, also the ventriloquist. Mm-hmm. I liked his story about how his grandfather inspired him to make sock puppets, and now he's a...
That was an amazing story. We were actually on a cruise ship, and he performed, and we were looking for stories everywhere. And when he did that routine at the end of the show, let me tell your listeners that so the routine was that after he goes through his whole act, he talks about how it was his grandfather who inspired him to go into ventriloquism, because he used to do shows for the grandchildren with sock puppets. And so we called him and we asked him if we could interview him, and he said yes, and we interviewed him on the cruise ship.
Yeah,
so,
cool.
That was great, yeah.
How was it interviewing Clooney?
Clooney is... amazing. Clooney, we actually have a personal connection to Nick Clooney. My husband is an identical twin, and they're both journalists. And my brother-in-law actually was on the air with Nick Clooney in Cincinnati.
Oh, wow.
Nick Clooney was the anchor for many years at WKRC, not WKRP. That was the fictionalized show.
Right,
remember,
right.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
Right.
So
I'm a little young to have watched it, but I'm aware of it.
Yeah, the reruns. Everyone watches reruns. So we thought that Nick Clooney's story was incredibly compelling. You know, the way he talked about his sisters, Rosemary and Betty, and for your listeners who don't know who they were Rosemary in particular was a pretty famous singer in the 50s and 60s. I don't remember Betty, but he said that, you know, she died very young. And then he talked about his son George Clooney, whom everybody knows, who's the actor married to Amal Clooney. And he talked about his grandfather's legacy of, social responsibility. And he feels that this lives on in George. And that's why he got involved in Darfur. But Nick actually did some events with us when we were in Cincinnati.
Oh,
and,
cool.
And he's just a really great guy.
Yeah. I think it's amazing that, you know, getting some of these higher profile people to tell their stories is great, because for me personally, when I heard, whenever I've heard stories of people that are in my field, that have been successful, that have gone through the similar things as I've gone through, you know, hearing about other comedians that have experienced the loss of a sibling or just, you know, traumatic loss and have still made it to the top of their game is always inspiring to me to see that it's possible.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that doing the book and interviewing the people, I'll just speak for myself, really helped me heal myself.
Mm-hmm.
It was very comforting. It was cathartic. It was therapeutic. These people were role models. I saw that they transcended their grief and they made something positive of it. In some cases, it was as simple as just making, you know, their mother's recipes on a holiday. In other cases, people did amazing things. They created foundations, you know, in the memory of them. And I believe you did that for your brother, right?
Yeah. My family has a foundation in my brother's memory as well. Yeah,
which is just beautiful to, you know, to take that memory, to take the person's values and his name, and then help others with it. It's a wonderful thing.
It is. You know, I find that it was really a turning point for me and my folks about, you know, it allowed us to talk about my brother year round in a way that was not depressing at the end. The end of the story the story didn't end with his death and our grief. The story kind of starts there almost.
Well, that's the thing. I think that, you know, your inclination, especially right at the beginning, is to focus on how the person died rather than how they lived. But after a while, you know, if you can move past, you know, the terrible, wrenching loss, as Nick Clooney says in our book, and turn it into something positive, it really does help carry on the person's name. I mean, I know for myself, and I learned this from Nick Clooney and also from Yo Chang Ma, whom we interviewed for the book, who was the sister of Yo-Yo
Ma, yeah.
And she
mm-hmm.
talks about their father and how she carries on this children's orchestra society, which her father started. But they both said one of the best things you can do is start a scholarship in memory of your loved one. And, you know, we did the book as a tribute to my mother, but I wanted to do something for my father as well. And my father was a principal in Brentwood, New York.
Right.
And it's a pretty high needs district. So I created a scholarship. I give one to a boy and one to a girl each year. I go to the awards assembly, and with hundreds of other people who are also giving scholarships, I get to stand up and talk about my father, talk about his values, talk about his career.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the graduates are so thankful, but honestly, it does more for me than it does for them.
Yeah.
It's just such a wonderful therapeutic thing. I feel that my father is alive for me when I do that. And I've even met teachers and parents he worked with. And it's just, I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, there's no substitute for that, I think. You know, when you go through, for me anyway, you know, the beginning of those first couple of years of grief is so isolating. And by design, it's sort of very... It's so personal that it's almost impossible for it not to be isolating. Even when people reach out and want to be around you, it's still, for me, I was just very much in my head about it. And it wasn't until I really got to a point where we were able to, when we started this foundation and we started a scholarship in my brother's name at the CIA, the Culinary Institute,
yes.
Knowing that his legacy is helping other people, it was, you know, and trying to, you know, we had to go out and promote this event that we do. We do a fundraiser for the foundation every year, and you have to promote it. You have to go out, you have to get out there and talk about it and tell people what you're doing. And a lot of people that I talked to had no idea who I was or what I was doing. And even the people in my life that I was, you know, getting to know didn't necessarily know I had lost a sibling. So the beginning of that conversation is always a little rocky. You know, you start telling people about what you're doing, and it starts with my brother died. I could see people, you know, pulling away a little bit, shutting, you know, trying to find a way to. I often say I go to a support group for bereaved siblings, and that's a great sentence you can use if you ever want to get out of a conversation. People tend to leave you alone, but it's I found that once getting past the uncomfortable part of that conversation and getting to the part where I talk about what we do in his name and how we move his legacy forward, it's so much more uplifting and very cathartic to be able to share that with people. You know, when you open up yourself, people are way more open to letting you into their lives and their things as well.
Absolutely. And then people start sharing their own stories, which is, you know, one of the things that we've done is we've invited people to send in their own stories, and we've captured so many stories and you know, on the website, on Facebook, and people really want to have a place where they can go and share. And the truth is, everybody's going to have a loss sooner or later.
Oh yeah, it's inevitable. I mean, I think it's really strange that I mean, we're certainly not the only culture, American culture, but I think that for the most part, a lot of cultures don't really deal with death particularly well or at all. You know, I think men in particular are told to not really show their emotions. You know, we're still at a point where a couple of months out people tell you to get over it or to, you know, move on, or you, such and such wouldn't want you feeling this way. I mean, you know, I hate that part of it a lot when people tell you you shouldn't be feeling this way or so, you know, this is how I feel. I don't really have a choice sometimes in how I feel.
No, and grief is very individual. There's no timeline to grief. No one can tell you when it's going to end. I mean, if it ever ends, you know, and that would be how we define it. So that's why I like the idea of transforming the grief into something positive. Because if you think about it, life is a continuum. Everybody's born and everybody dies. So I do think that there is some truth when people say, you know, don't be unhappy about it. I think you have every right to be unhappy, but at some point you have to say, you know, would my loved one really want me to spend the rest of my life grieving, and then I'm going to die, and then someone's going to spend the rest of their life right. grieving, and then that person's going to die. So we're all going to die. So I guess what this has taught me with this whole process of speaking to people and writing the book and the Facebook, and I do a lot of speaking as well, is to count my blessings and to try to, you know, live in the here and now. And that's one of the things that we have in the journal, you know, count your blessings. What are your top 10? List the people who provide strength and comfort to you, because we're, you know, even in our grief, we are very blessed by having people around us and people who support us. So I think that's kind of what I learned from my losses also, that we have to, you know, be grateful for health, be grateful for the people who support us. And it sounds like a cliche, and maybe it is a cliche, but if you think about it, it's really not. I mean, we lost my sister-in-law 2 years ago, my brother-in-law's wife, the one who worked with Nick Clooney, and that was a whole different kind of a loss. But, you know, she had heart failure, so, you know, we don't think to be grateful that we're healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, I agree. I think I get to a point where I've as I say, you know, we don't have a choice as to how we feel about things. The only thing I can do is I know I have a choice as to how I react to how I feel. You know, sometimes I have to make a conscious effort to react in a way that's going to be positive. But sometimes that I don't manage to do that. A lot of times, most of the time, because it's been 14 years for me now, so I'm pretty good at recognizing what my patterns are and what my triggers are and stuff. And I make a very concentrated effort to consciously choose how I react to the way I feel about stuff. But sometimes it drags me down.
I still have a recurring dream. I have a dream that I'm trying to call my mother and she's not answering the phone. And then I have this, you know, every several months. And then I wake up and I realize, well, she can't answer the phone. She's dead. And so that's still with me. And, you know, the thing was, I talked to my mother several times a day. If there was a lull at work, I call my mother. If something good happened, I call my mother. If something bad happened, I call my mother. And I don't, you know, I just don't have that in my life anymore. So.
Yeah. How long after your parents died did you start working on the book? How long of a process did you wait before you started thinking about doing this?
Well, as I said, my parents died a year and a half apart. So I would say I first broached the topic to my brother in February 2009. We were in Manhattan together. My husband wasn't sure he wanted to do it, but once he heard my brother was doing it, he was on board. Actually, his parents died while we were in the process of writing the book. So in February 2009, I said, I really want to do this. Now, I am a person who always has a project. And let me say that that was one of the reasons we called it the Living Memories Project, because my mother's saying was, if I said I was sad or bored or depressed, she'd say, get yourself a project. And a project could be anything from cleaning a closet to writing a book. So I always felt that in addition to my work, I always needed a project. So I asked, I had broached it to my husband. He wasn't sure. But once my brother said he was on board, he decided he was going to be in on it. And one of the reasons I wanted my brother to be involved in it, because it was a tribute to my mother, and I thought that would make my mother very pleased that we were working on it together. So we decided then in February 2009 we were going to do it, and then we had to go about the task figuring out how we were going to execute it. I knew I couldn't execute it by myself.
Right.
It was just way too big for me to execute by myself. So then the three of us mapped out a plan, mm-hmm. which began with making a lot of lists of high-profile people who had spoken about loss, and then other people.
Yeah. Did you have to do a – did you come up with like a list of questions that you would use to prompt them, or you
yeah.
just – yeah. Because, I mean, I came up with a list of questions when I first started this podcast that pretty much I don't even really refer to anymore. I find that the story comes out of the people without really – most people that sit down with me, it's not about asking the right questions. It's just about giving them enough time
well,
to feel comfortable opening up.
I'm a teacher and a student, so I – you know, when I got my doctorate, I did my dissertation. I interviewed people about another topic, and they were very strict. You had to have this an interview protocol, and you had to ask everybody the same question.
Right.
So that was kind of ingrained in me. So we did have a set of questions that we asked everybody. But obviously, if someone went off on a tangent, we followed it.
What was your dissertation on?
My dissertation, so I have a doctorate in education. My dissertation was caring schools, how principals promote an ethos of caring
okay.
in their schools. So I interviewed principals.
Nice. In New York, mostly?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I feel like, you know, New Yorkers, we're pretty brash.
Well, it was... mostly Long Island.
Long Island, right.
Long Island is brash also, I guess. Yeah, I found that it was really interesting. So my conclusion really was that, you know, caring about the student as an individual, meeting the child's needs where the child was, contributed to academic success. I mean, no shock, but I think the idea is really catching on a lot more now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of things are changing now. The conversations about loss and about grief that I've encountered in the last couple of years, I think, is really starting to become a thing. You know, people are talking more about some of these things, you know, about the taboos and about the things that people you have had normally pushed into the corners.
I've noticed that, you know, even, you know, since we started working on the book, we said, oh, no, but who wants to read a book about that? You know, and it just seems that now there are more and more people talking and writing about it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't know why that is, but...
No, I think, I mean, part of it is the internet, you know. Everybody has a voice now, and the niche markets are coming alive, I think. You know, the internet is connecting people that were previously feeling alone because they didn't have a community. But every niche interest has a community now. I mean, I'm part of a Facebook group that's got like 2,000 people in it, and it's all just bereaved siblings from all over the world.
Wow. Well, we actually, we're close to 5,000 likes on our Facebook page, which is just incredible.
Yeah. So I think the access to other people going through similar things is at an all-time high right now. I don't think that there has ever been, a time where you can really connect with people going through, you know, where you can really put yourself out there in a way that isn't just screaming into the void.
Are you familiar with the Death Cafe movement?
I am somewhat. Yeah, I had a woman on. She actually my very first interview. I don't know if you know this woman, Nancy Gershman.
I know the name. Mm-hmm.
She, I think, was one of the founders of the Death Cafe thing. She's one of the reasons that I have this podcast in the first place as well. She has a blog called Tragicomedia, and she interviewed me for her blog. She interviews humorists and writers about loss.
Okay.
Particularly talking about the dichotomy between the comedy and the tragedy. Mm. And it was in talking to her, and then another friend of mine who did a podcast about people's childhoods, comedians' childhoods. Those two elements together got me thinking about doing this podcast in the first place, because I think it's just for me as a comedian, it was just surreal to be in a position where I get to go on stage every night and present a version of myself to an audience and basically talk about whatever the fuck I want. But I really couldn't talk about this. It wasn't, I wasn't particularly comfortable talking about it, and audiences were even less comfortable.
So do you talk about it now, or you still don't talk about it?
I touch on it. You know, I have that one joke that I about going to the support group. I have a couple of jokes that I do about speaking at different bereavement conferences. I have a handful of little things that I do, and it really depends on the audience, and it depends on what it is I'm trying to do. So if I'm just doing like a regular club show, you know, in the Village or whatever, I don't usually do it. But if I'm doing a show that I know people in the audience are going to be able to connect to it, I'll do it. Or if it's something that I'm trying to work on, I have a handful of shows that I know I can get away with doing that stuff on. Mm-hmm. But I've often talked about how sometimes that material is so personal that when it doesn't work, it's like 10 times as upsetting than when a joke doesn't work.
Oh, absolutely. I would imagine it would be crushing.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on how it goes. I find that I can tell when an audience is really uncomfortable with me taking them in that direction. And sometimes that doesn't change. Sometimes you get to the end of the piece of material and they are leaning in a bit more. You know, they want to know a little bit more. But I'd say it's about 75% of the time the audience will come with you.
Okay. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
75%.
I mean, part of it is my own comfortability with it. You know, I think in the beginning, when I first started doing those jokes, I was really nervous about doing them because of just how personal it is and how connected I am to the reaction. And I've become a lot more adept, I think, at exuding a confidence in knowing that even if this falls, even if this piece of stuff really falls on its face, don't worry. We're going to I'll steer us back into calmer waters.
Look, the truth is that some people are not comfortable with it. They'll never be comfortable with it. I mean, I have close friends who they just don't want to discuss it. They don't.
Yeah.
That's not their thing.
Well, my thing is I really don't give a shit whether or not I make you uncomfortable.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Like
good for you.
Like it took me time to get there. I it didn't happen overnight, but I've gotten to a point now where I'm very casual about the way I talk about my loss and about what I do to service it. You know, I think it's all about my attitude. If people aren't comfortable with what I'm talking about, I could care less. I'm going to talk about what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be me. I'm going to continue to talk about my brother. And if it makes you uncomfortable, well, that's on you. That's not on me.
Well, you have a responsibility and obligation to talk about him because we want to keep his memory alive. Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I actually run this support group for siblings,
and
I've been doing that for, I don't know, about 7 years. The last 5 years, I've been presenting workshops on sibling grief at the national conference of my organization. And I'm, you know, I feel like I'm kind of rising through the ranks of...
What is that, Compassionate Friends?
The Compassionate Friends, yeah. I've been rising through the ranks within their organization.
It's wonderful.
Pretty quickly, based mostly on the fact that I'm a, you know, I'm a comedian, so I'm a better public speaker than most.
Mm-hmm.
And I look for the jokes. You know, I look for the little fringe things that you can laugh at, because the facts themselves are just so depressing, but there's always little things on the outer edge about certain scenarios or social situations that you can always find laughter and humor in. And that's where I kind of live, is looking for those, you know, I like being the peanut gallery in the back, you know, the back row where you get to sort of make a, look at this guy, look at what's happening over here. You know, the little things that are just inevitable in interaction that are not necessarily related to any specific type of grief or loss or whatever. The little things on the edges is kind of where I find myself most comfortable.
Well, I think it's you're really doing a service by helping people with sibling loss, because I think that is a loss that sometimes is overlooked. I mean, we have a few people in the Living Memories Project who lost siblings. Obviously, Malachi McCourt.
Mm-hmm.
Who lost several siblings. He talks about the loss of his brother Frank, who wrote Angela's Ashes.
Right.
But for those who've read it, know that he lost other siblings as children. We have Gary Toll, the filmmaker, who talked about his sister, and Ellen Gould, who wrote a play about it. And it seems to me that this is just a loss that hasn't gotten enough attention.
Yeah, no, I talk about it a lot, about how the siblings are sort of the forgotten mourners, in mm-hmm. a sense. We're often told that we have to be strong for our parents, we have to do this.
Right.
So it's a tough thing. But I do I don't really have a choice myself in doing this work. It is part of what beyond the foundation, doing this work allows me to feel connected to my brother. You know, this is another arm of his legacy, in my opinion. You know, these are ways that I get to continue my relationship with him by helping others, but also by putting his name out there.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And I feel that by helping ourselves, we're really helping others as well, because we're helping others to talk about it and to, if they choose, you know, keep the memories alive. You know, don't just forget about it. I mean, some people think, you know, I'm not going to mention it. I'm not going to mention the name. I mean, that I learned that, no, you have to mention the name. People want to hear the name.
Yeah.
And people want to hear the little stories about their loved ones. You know, certainly in the Jewish tradition, you know, you have the funeral and then you sit Shiva for 7 days and then everybody goes away,
yeah.
Kind of. But after, a month after, 6 months after, a year after, 2 years, 3 years, yeah, talk about, you know, some experience or an anecdote about the person who was gone. I mean, I love that,
yeah.
when people do that, when they'll talk about, you know, my mother or my father or my sister-in-law. I really like that.
Yeah, me too. Well, that's why I like the book so much. You know, I find that so many books about grief are, or about loss, a lot of them are very clinical or very dry. And I connect more to personal stories, and I really love that it's so many different stories from different people. There's a different feel to every story in the book.
Yeah.
You know, you can really hear the different voices of each of the people that you've interviewed in there. They're so varied. Especially, one of my favorite stories in the book is the Israelis.
Sherry Mandel.
Yeah. I mean, this the camp that they started is just amazing. It's, what is it? Page 103.
You tell me.
Yeah, it's 103.
You tell me.
They lost their son at 13 in a
a terrorist incident.
Yeah.
I mean, what could be worse? What could be worse than that? I mean, I like, you know, what she says. She says, you always carry the pain with you. It's always going to be there. Grief is energy and power, and you have to harness it. If you don't do something, it will destroy you. You have to find something within the love you have for a person to continue.
Yep.
And I mean, they did amazing thing. Another couple who in the Living Memories Project, Legacies That Last, were the Aldermans, Steve and Liz Alderman, whose 25-year-old son, Peter, was killed on 9/11
right.
in the World Trade Center. And they said they knew nothing about the world of philanthropy when they started, but they knew they had to do something to honor Peter's memory. And Peter had a lot of friends. So they started with his friends, and they thought that a fitting memorial to him would be to help other victims of torture, terrorism. So they go all over the third world, and they set up with the indigenous people there. They do not want American volunteers. They want people from the culture that they're doing it, so they will understand the culture. And they set up mental health clinics to treat victims of torture terrorism. And let me just see if I can find it.
I think that's amazing, though, you know, just taking your own pain and using it, harnessing it to help others going through the same thing is there's no substitute for that, I don't think.
No. And she says that it just changed their whole life. It changed the trajectory of their life. They keep Peter's name alive. They keep his memory alive. And it just, you know, provides them with a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just an amazing thing.
Yeah. I think it's great. Are you guys working on another book? I thought I saw something on the website about how you're doing a second one now.
Well, we're always working on something else. So we have a lot of possibilities. One of the things is to do Holocaust legacies of, you know, the survivors and the next generation. I don't know. I've been approached by professionals to do something on suicide, something on, you know, so we will be doing another book. And I'd also, probably, you know, depending on how well this does, would like to do additional journals for different
mm-hmm.
subgroups.
Yeah. Cool.
And we're also looking, we've partnered with certain individuals and organizations. We're always looking for partners. The JCC of Suffolk County is going to do the Living Memories Project conference on bereavement and grief on December 16th, which is going to be aimed at professionals in the field, and we'll be speaking there. So
this is an event that you're going to be speaking at.
It's a conference.
A conference, okay.
Yeah, in Comac, New York. Here,
let's take a look here. And it's December 16th, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's open to other – anybody can go?
Yeah, you can go. You have to register. They haven't
right.
– they're still developing the materials, but I thought since I was here I would take the opportunity to plug it. It is – professionals can receive continuing education credits, but it's also open to the public as well.
Yeah, these types of things are important to go to, I think. I go to my national conference every year, and it's of the Compassionate Friends. It the value of being around so many people that are there for the same reason is intoxicating almost.
Well, it normalizes it.
Yeah, exactly. It does. It normalizes it. That's exactly what it is. I mean, if it wasn't for my conference every year, I don't know if I would have been able to find my voice really again. You know, it was the socialization, the normalizing of just being around people that got it. That was so important.
Yeah, I think that that's why we're really, you know, looking to partner with different groups and different individuals, and you know, we're scheduling events and speaking, but we're definitely open to, you know, working with other people in the field and presenting programs and that kind
yeah.
of thing. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just at the precipice now. I'm just starting to really start to put together, I guess, what my new act is going to be, in a sense. You know, try to get away from the dick jokes and the pot jokes and start doing more
adult
grief jokes.
grief jokes.
Or at the very least, you know, just having a more succinct message beyond the jokes. Because I've been, you know, I've been speaking at more of these events myself now.
Were some of the other events you spoke at?
Well, I mean, so I've spoken at a couple of the national conferences. Later this month, I'm actually performing / speaking at a benefit in Pennsylvania that's very similar to the benefit that my family throws, but instead it's just a different family.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually my first paid grief comedy booking.
Wow.
Which is pretty exciting. I've done everything by trial and error, mostly error. So we're going to see how this one goes. I have a good feeling about it, but I always say that, you know, speaking in front speaking at a bereavement conference or speaking in front of a group of bereaved people is a lot easier than just doing straight comedy, partially because I don't have to worry about how I'm doing.
Right. So do you strive to be funny or you don't?
I do.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I certainly do. But I think that you have to understand how far out you can go. You know, you want to keep the comedy pretty much consistent with what it is you're talking about. You can't go too far, you know, you can't take a tangent too far. You know, you really want to kind of, especially when you're talking about the grief stuff, it's important to focus on why you're there and why everybody else is there. And so going too far astray from what the subject matter is can be off-putting, you know. I mean, for the same reason that it's hard to do grief material than in a regular comedy set and then go back to dick jokes afterwards.
Right. Now, have you participated in any panel discussions? Because we like to do panels, you know, you know, to have different perspectives.
Yeah.
Have you done that?
I've done a couple of panels, mostly at the conference. Uh-huh. I've done some panel stuff, yeah. Yeah. I'm working on, I'm not sure when it's going to come to fruition, but I've been working on there's a woman in the city that has been putting together these showcases called Funny Sad People.
Oh.
And the first one was about depression, and the next one is going to be about comedy and loss.
Okay.
And, my idea was to have three other comedians that have gone through loss, and we each come out and do a brief stand-up set, mm-hmm. and then sit down for panel discussion about what it is. Because there are a handful of comedians out there that I know that I've had on the podcast and whatnot that have material about their loss, that do jokes about what they've gone through, and in some cases. I find that if you're going to do a longer piece about your loss, it's very difficult to do it in a regular comedy set. Most people do it as a one-man show, one-person show. I know a number of comedians out there that have done a more theatrical piece that is very funny, but that is, you know, a bit more dramatic. Like, for example, the Billy Crystal 700 Sundays.
Yes, you know, we mentioned that in the book.
You know, that type of show, very powerful. But also, you wouldn't be able to do a lot of that material in a regular comedy club,
right?
You know,
people have to know what they're signing up for.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. People, that's exactly what it is. People need to know what they're going about to be watching.
Right.
So I think it's been, I don't know, it's been interesting to make that transition for me from just doing straight comedy to going a little deeper into what I've, you know, what I've been doing.
But I could also see a role for you just, you know, your profession as being a comedian, but you could talk about it, you know, and not, you could throw in a few, I'm just saying participating in a panel.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah. I'm, that's the interesting thing, though. I find that comedy takes so much precision, especially in the editing, I would say. You know, you come up with an idea and you put it in front of an audience and then you sort of listen back to it and figure out where the laughs really are and what you can cut out and how you can get to the joke faster. When you're talking about loss, the most important part is just to be honest, I think, and be open. And the organic nature of those kinds of conversations, even when you're on a panel, are, you know, people connect when they know you're being genuine and you're not reading off a script.
Absolutely.
And that's true in comedy as well, but comedy can still work if you're doing material that is, you know, memorized. But I find that when you're speaking from the heart, there's no substitute for that. And an audience knows it intrinsically as soon as they see it, I think. And I find that my comfortability with talking about it is, it's just one of the more, it's so natural for me to get into those kinds of discussions in ways that trying to shoehorn a joke into that discussion is, I don't know. The jokes that come up for me in those scenarios fit naturally.
Oh, okay.
In a way. Because I'm not worried about trying to shoehorn a joke in. You know what I'm saying? I'm just speaking off the top. And sometimes I get good jokes that come off the top. And sometimes they're not appropriate. But I put them out there.
Okay, well, that's great. Because I totally agree with you that people want the authenticity and the honesty. But I think this is a topic you can't really talk about unless you're honest and authentic about it.
No, for sure. I just think that there are ways, it, like anything else, it's one of those things where you can find yourself stuck in a script about it in the way you promote it, you know. So I think that there are, when you're sitting in front of an audience, you can have your notes and whatnot, you know, make sure you want to remember to hit certain key things. But like, you know, like I go to my, you know, when I go to these conferences and you see some of the keynote speakers and some of them, most of them are reading something that they've written, and some of them are just using what they've written as a jumping off point to keep themselves on track. Mm-hmm. And, the people that are really speaking to you rather than at you are more engaging.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, in my professional life, I spoke a lot and I always wrote everything out. And I find that when I speak about this topic, I might have a few notes, but I don't want to stand up there and read it. I just, it comes from a very deep well.
Right.
And it's not really necessary, you know, unless, you know, maybe you could worry about being nervous, but I don't worry about that, you know, so I'll have it, but I just would rather talk about it.
Yeah. Me too. I think, you know, somebody told me that I had a book in me.
I'm sure you do.
But I'm so much more comfortable working in a verbal medium than I am in a written medium. I'm a perfectionist when it comes to the writing process. So I've written stuff for the newsletter of my local chapter. Mm-hmm. And I've written a couple things for the national newsletter, but I'm so on the editing process of writing that stuff for me is very difficult.
Well, I'm definitely going to write about you in my blog.
Yeah.
And, hopefully you'll make your way into a subsequent book of ours. Yeah.
Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed. I wonder how much editing did you do on these interviews after the fact? So you were saying that you had a handful of questions that you asked, but these all seem to be pretty straightforward stories. So I don't know. I wonder what the editing process.
We did edit. We did edit. Although originally we thought maybe we would try to make them all about the same length, and that just didn't work out because it just didn't.
Right.
But we tried to edit it so they kind of had the same structure and they were readable. And we spent a lot of time editing, a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's why we gave what we wanted to print to the people to make sure that they felt that it reflected their voice. Interestingly, originally we were not going to have them in the first person, and my son said, no, you have to have it in the first person. You have to have the people speaking in their own voice. That will make it much more powerful. And we think that it did.
Yeah, no, totally. I agree. I mean, that's, as I said, I connect to these personal stories. You know, an anecdote about someone that you lost is way more interesting than talking about whatever the, you know, the stages of grief or the, you know, the clinical approach to it. I think it's the personal stories that I connect to, and I think that people connect to.
I mean, we're just so grateful to the people who participated, you know, for telling their story, for opening up, and really, I'll just say for myself, helping me to heal myself and to find a pathway to enjoy my life again, because I have to say that I spent at least a couple or more years being very miserable.
Yeah.
And I now, you know, I'm sad that my mother didn't get to see, you know, two of my sons get married, and she only got to see one great-grandchild. Now we have more, and she missed out on so much, and her own mother lived to almost 90, and we just thought that she would, but she didn't, and that's just a fact of life. But, you know, people are living. My husband's aunt just died last week. She was 99, you know, so, but you can't think about that, you know.
Yeah.
So it was just a gift to have the person for as long as you did, and just they're with you. One of my favorite quotes, which is in the My Living Memories Project journal. I don't know why it didn't make its way into the original book, but this is just, it's a Buddhist saying. When my brother was alive, I knew him in 50 different ways. Now I know him in 49 different ways.
Mm.
So,
wow.
You know, your brother is not physically present, but he's still in your life in so many ways.
Completely. Oh, I mean, I've made that my mission. You know, it's about, you know, it's about counting your blessings. The thing that you were talking about earlier. I spent so many years just in my own despair. You know, I think it, and society does this to you as well, because of the fact that you don't have too many outlets and places to go to talk about this stuff. I've had to make the conscious effort to count my blessings, to look at the things that I have in my life and really be grateful for all the things that I have and have had, versus spending my life being upset for about the one thing I don't.
Exactly.
So, you know, I mean, sure. Okay. My brother died at 21 and it's horrible. You know, I'm not going to be able to, I'm going to end up spending more of my life without him than I ever did with him. But none of my life would be what it is without having had him in the first place. Nothing that I am would be without having had him in the first place. So I have to be grateful for having had him in my life in the first place to inform the rest of my life. And I find ways to have my relationship with him continue on as many levels as I can.
And, you know, I saw the interview that you and your parents did with Heidi.
On the Open to Hope, yeah.
Horsley. I think your parents are amazing. And it looked like you have an awesome relationship with your parents.
Yeah. Oh, no, I do. My parents and I are very close. We were always a close family. My mother was like the first mother in the family travel industry. So we always went on family vacations. My dad was in a position where he could take as much, take time off. And so we went on a lot of family vacations. We spent a lot of time together as a family. And I remember specifically the very first thing I said to my parents after Russell died was, we have always been a strong family, and we're going to continue to be a strong family. And we have found ways to connect with each other on a personal level versus, our relationship changed drastically in the sense that there was still the parent and child dynamic, but there was also this other dynamic where we were three people just grieving the right. loss of the same person. And so we've found even the playing field in a way, and we're still very close.
That's evident. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I see them almost every day.
That's great.
You know,
do they live near here?
They live in the city. Yeah. They live in the same place where I grew up. And I often say they've turned my room into a guest room, of which I am a frequent guest.
Well, good for them. We had to move to reclaim our son's rooms. They came home from college and they dumped their stuff in their rooms and it stayed there. So we finally moved and they took the stuff.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, that's my parents. I would be livid with my parents if they left. Their apartment is amazing. It's one of the coolest apartments in the city. And, but beyond that, I think, I was living with them when Russell died, and I continued to stay there for about another 5 years. I lived with them after Russell died, which, who knows whether or not it was a benefit or a.
Was he living at home when he died?
No. Yes and no. He was going to school. He was at the Culinary Institute upstate, mm-hmm. and he was living in a house with some people up there. But he came down to the city just about every weekend.
Okay.
And when he came down, we shared a room. We had shared a room as children, and then when we were in our teen years, my parents put a wall up in the middle of the room, so we had our privacy.
So did my husband and his identical twin brother. Same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's the wall.
Yeah. And then when we both went off to college, they took the wall down. And my mom had this thing built. They built a custom-made wall unit. It's basically bookcases that have Murphy beds behind them.
Oh, wow.
So we have matching Murphy beds. And the Murphy beds are still there. But, one of them was mine and one of them was Russell's. And when we were both there, we could both sleep there. But when we weren't there, there were no beds in the room. You just closed the doors.
So the Culinary Institute is an amazing place. We went there, I don't know, several years ago, and we had a meal there. Did your brother have a specialty that he was studying?
Yeah, he was a pastry chef.
Oh, wow.
He was just about to graduate from the pastry program there.
Mm.
Yeah. And in fact, last year, maybe it was 2 years ago now, we sponsored one of the chairs in the auditorium where they hold the graduations.
Mm-hmm.
It's the very first row. It's the middle seat in the front row center, and the plaque on the back of it will only be ever seen by other pastry students that are graduating, because this is where all the graduates sit when they do the graduations. And our plaque reads: "This chair is in memory of Russell Ferber, butter enthusiast."
Oh yes, I saw that butter. Will you please explain that to me? That is something I wanted to ask you because I saw that.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well,
he used a lot of butter.
Yeah, butter. Butter makes everything better.
I love butter.
Yeah, I mean, when we were kids growing up, Russell used to just eat butter by not like a whole stick, but he would basically eat the butter while he would. And when you are in pastry, it's all about the butter. The more butter you put in stuff, the better. I mean, it's really.
Did he cook at home? Did you bake at home? Did you eat some of his pastries and they were amazing?
Amazing.
So are there any that you eat now to remind you?
Well, we often use his brownie recipe. We have his brownie recipe. We have his cookie recipe. When my mom makes pies and stuff and pie crusts, she uses a lot of his old recipes for, getting a good flaky crust.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of his recipes that we get to use. If we can read them, his handwriting was pretty much chicken scratch. So we have to try to find one that he had typed up.
But I think food is a wonderful way of keeping memories alive. Oh, yeah. You know, we have this woman.
We also, the other recipe that we make a lot of is my grandmother's mandelbread recipe, which my mom did not make for Rosh Hashanah. Shame on her, but I have the recipe and I can make it whenever I want. The mandelbread. Are you you're familiar with the mandelbread?
Yeah? Of course, I'm familiar with them. Is it with fruit or chocolate chips?
Chocolate chips.
That makes
and,
it better.
And
with
walnuts.
Chocolate.
Yeah,
absolutely.
For those of you that don't know, it's basically Jewish biscotti is what we're talking about.
That's
the mandelbread.
That's a good way of putting it. So this Flory Wachtenheim in both books talks about how she makes her mother's gefilte fish.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know the
old joke about gefilte fish? You know why nobody's ever been able to catch a gefilte fish?
Why?
It takes one bite of the bait, sends it back.
Well, she makes the gefilte fish and rugelach. She said she makes it for every holiday. And she says, my mother is in my head and in my heart as I look at the recipe, make it, compose the menu. And then she says it's so wonderful when her children or, you know, nieces or nephews recognize it as her mother's or their grandmother's recipe. So
yeah.
I think that's very powerful. In fact, what we do, my mother was a big chocolate enthusiast, loved chocolate, as we all do.
Chocoholic.
Yep, absolutely. And so what we do for our Seder, Passover Seder, and I have to really look hard to find them now, but they, I think Manischewitz puts it out. There might be a couple of other companies. It's a dark chocolate Seder plate, shaped like a Seder plate. And we start our Seder. I mean, I have grandchildren now. So, why is this night different from every other night? Well, one of the reasons is because we start the meal with dessert.
Nice.
And we pass around the chocolate Seder plate in memory of my mother, the chocoholic.
Oh, I love it. That's great. My mom makes the matzah candy on Passover for the Seder, for the dessert.
What is that?
It's a matzah covered in toffee. And dark chocolate.
Oh, that must be okay.
Oh yeah, and
it neutralizes the matzah. You don't taste the matzah.
I don't know.
Or are you one of these people who likes matzah?
I like matzah with a nice
butter,
topping
with
on
butter.
It.
With butter.
With butter, I like it with butter. With
matzah pizza.
Some charosis. I'm big on my mom always used to make double the amount of charosis that she would normally make for the Seder because my brother and I would just eat it. We would finish it before the Seder. The charosis, which is the apples and the walnuts and the red wine.
Right, right.
So good.
It's very good. I always thought, though, that there would be another purpose that I could use it in some other recipe afterwards, but I don't know what that would be.
Charosis?
Yeah. Hmm. Pancakes? I don't know.
Pancakes? I don't know. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I always find that, I talk about the Jewish religion. It's all about the food. We're all about the meal. The old Jewish joke is that you can sum up all of Jewish history with three phrases. They tried to kill us. We won.
Let's eat. Right.
That's the old joke.
That is true.
But I think, the recipe thing is powerful because I think that we all have these flavors that we grow up with. And so being able to pass recipes down, you get to taste a bit of your childhood again. It's sort of nostalgic in a sense.
Yeah. I just was speaking to a friend of mine who put together her own cookbook just for the members of her family, with her recipes, her mother's recipes, her grandmother's recipes, and she put in pictures of family occasions. I thought that was a really neat thing to do.
Yeah. I like that stuff. I think we should probably put together a book of Russell's recipes, I guess, if we could find it. The funny thing is
absolutely.
Is that
absolutely.
My favorite thing is that, Russell was not only was he a great pastry chef, but he could cook just about, he had a lot of other recipes that he was good at. And the funny thing is that he would come to your, if he came to your house to cook for you, he would use every goddamn pot and pan you had.
I know who cleaned it up after.
Oh, yeah. He didn't clean shit.
Yeah, that's...
He would use every fucking thing you had to make something and just leave it.
Well, that's the difficult part about cooking is cleaning up.
Yeah.
So what kind of... I always thought that if you were a pastry chef, you didn't cook. So what... He just cooked...
I don't remember now. It's been a while.
Yeah.
I don't know. He cooked. He was good at cooking. I mean, he was a big steak guy. He was a meat and potatoes type of guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Yeah. Well, if you can find his some of his pastries, we should really get them out to the world.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I talk about the dessert a lot on this podcast. Probably too much. I probably talk too much about the food.
People well, you look like you're able to handle it, right?
I'm trying to get in better shape. I'm getting a little chubby there.
Nah.
But I have to say, you know, I don't know. It's interesting to me how, just the path that I've been on, and I don't know if you felt this way in the course of doing this book and doing this work, if this is the type, it's so out of left field for me. Like, just 5-6 years ago, if you told me I would be doing this podcast, you know, talking to, like, it's just so, it's such a left turn from what I was, the path I thought I was on.
Totally, totally. Okay, so I started my career as a high school social studies teacher. Then when my children were small, I got into writing, and I worked as a journalist. And in fact, one of the things I did was write a food column.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then I went back, and I told you I got my doctorate in educational administration, and then I became an administrator in school. So I actually retired as an assistant superintendent.
Wow, okay.
And then, you know, in a million years I wouldn't think that I would be doing this. Not in a million years, but I do feel that my mother in some way set me on this path. You know, I believe, you know, I always adhere to her. You need a project. You have to have a project. But also, after I stopped with my full-time job, which involved being at work at 8 in the morning and 3 or 4 nights a week coming home at 10 or 11 p.m., it was very all-consuming. I wanted to do something. I did some education consulting, but then this came to me, and this is my passion now. This is my mission. And I'm just so happy that I can help other people, because people, just the same way that you're doing, you know, we're giving a voice to people. And I just feel that people, you know, if they can just focus on those memories, it is healing. It is healing. And I'm just so happy that I didn't spend the rest of my life being miserable.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to help other people not be miserable. So yeah. This is my calling now. But you never, never could have predicted this ever.
Yeah. I would. I mean, it's just crazy to me that I find that this has been, I feel like I'm kind of finding my calling in a sense, you know, doing this. And it's, you know, it feels so good to be able to give people the voice, to be able to share my story, but also let other people share their stories.
Well, that's the thing. People have a real hunger to share their stories. And, you know, you have to provide a safe space for them to do it.
It's so imperative, I think. You know, I say also, I as I've been saying, you know, this work that I do is, in my opinion, part of my brother's legacy. You know, this is the stuff that I hope eventually his name stays alive through. And you know, one of the things that I connect to this one idea is that I don't even remember where I read this, but I read that you die 3 deaths. You die when your physical body dies. You die again when the last person who knew you dies. And you die finally when the last person who says your name out loud dies.
I think that's probably true.
And I think that's a very powerful idea, you know, and it is through, I really do hope that through doing a lot of this work that my brother's name carries on way beyond mine. You know,
I hope your name carries on as well.
Well, if it does, I'm sure. I just hope they spell it correctly. That's really the
J-O-R-D-O-N.
D-O-N. That is correct. Yeah. If you spell it with an A, I got to correct it and it becomes anarchy. So that's really, there's hope for us yet, I would say. Well, I can't thank you enough for schlepping all the way out to Brooklyn to come out here. Thank you so much for sitting down with me. I want to make sure people know all about the book. Go out there and get the book, The Living Memories Project and The Living Memories Project Journal, which just came out. I can't recommend it enough. I have to say that I haven't finished reading it completely, but what I love about it is that I can really just jump around. You can get it on Amazon. Yeah. I will put a link to the Amazon page on into the show notes. I look forward to the next book whenever that comes out. And I'll share the Facebook page and the website as well. I think that there's always a lot of it's good to have, you know, just a place where you can connect with people online in ways that you might not have previously thought of. So.
And thank you again, Jordan. Thank you for inviting me and for this really wonderful conversation. And I wish you the best.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to plug? You're on Twitter as well, right? I know you're on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I haven't done Instagram yet. Have you done Instagram?
I'm on Instagram.
Should I do it?
I mean, I don't know. How many pictures do you put up?
I don't know.
I don't. I'm not big on Instagram. I don't have Snapchat or any of those, you know, I'm at, one of these days I'll probably have a Snapchat. I don't know. I don't need any of that stuff. I personally do Twitter, but I'm not even great at Twitter because I'm so long winded. I can't keep anything to 140 characters.
That is true.
Yeah. Well, this has been fantastic, and I hope you guys get the book, and please go on to the iTunes and rate and review the show. It makes a huge difference on the rating system. If you guys can go on there and do that, it would mean so much to me. And I thank you guys for listening. My name is Jordan Ferber. This is Where's the Grief? We will be here next time. Goodbye. Hooray.
Of the flame, my torch of love lights his name. Ask no pity, but my shame.